All right, good morning. Can you guys hear us okay? It's such a big room, part of me feels like saying, move forward, we don't bite. You know, we are friendly. We showered and brushed our teeth this morning. Good morning, welcome to Exchange Online Protection Notes from the Field. I'm Jennifer Gagnon. I am the Supportability Program Manager responsible for protection, so anti-spam, antivirus, as part of the Information Protection Team. Another section of my role is archiving and e-discovery. But today I'm going to focus on protection with Wendy here.
I'm a program manager on the Office 365 CXP CAT team, and my focus is also on the email hygiene. And Jennifer and I have a long history with each other and with the filtering product. We've both worked on it for more than 8 years each.
Yes, absolutely. So today we're here to talk a little bit about Exchange Online Protection, as I said, but I'm just curious, how many folks are familiar with Forefront Online Protection for Exchange or FOPI? Oh, excellent. That's fantastic. Anybody using Exchange Online Protection today or thinking about it? Excellent. And is there a couple of folks, there's a few hands that didn't go up. Anybody thinking about it but hasn't quite gotten there yet? All right, fantastic. I like to see all those hands. So we're going to talk today about a high level as to what Exchange Online Protection is, and then we're going to go into showing you some of the manageability that you have available to you, and then at the end we'll talk about some best practices that we recommend for the organization. So Exchange Online Protection is a multi-engine anti-malware and spam filtering service that you can use to help protect your mail environment from threats. We do have the flexibility of administration tools to help you with your policy enforcement from your corporation, as well as to help kind of gauge a little bit on your anti-spam filtering and anti-malware as well. We do have some service level agreements for the service. We kind of broke it into two categories, one around mail delivery, so we do have 5-9 uptime for the service. We are geo-redundant as well. With that geo-redundancy, we also have message queuing for 2 days, so if your server happens to go down for whatever reason, maybe you take it offline for maintenance, no need to worry as long as it's within those 2 days. We'll continue to try and deliver those messages to you and make sure that they get to the end, or help make sure they get to the end once you come back up online. We also have 24/7 live phone support, and we also have web technical support available for you should you have any issues that you need to contact us about. From a filtering performance perspective, we do track our anti-malware, so we have 100% known virus detection where there is active payload within the message itself. We also have 99% spam detection rate, and our false positive ratio is pretty decent with less than 1 out of 250,000 messages.
We're usually much better than that, but that's our committed SLA.
So next I want to go through a high level of how our inbound mail filtering works, for those that may not be familiar. So your mail starts at the internet, and it comes to our data centers through an MX record resolution. It starts at the edge, and at the edge we have our IP-based edge blocking. We do subscribe to some third parties that we partner with, but we also have our own in-house proprietary IP block listing, where we've actually used that information, or we gather that information based on the traffic that we see that comes across our network. We also have some URL blocking as well. This is where we have some known URLs that are intended to be malicious, and so out of that list, we block that mail as well so that we can ensure that those known ones are not making it through to the end user. If everything works out fine on that edge, then it goes through over into the virus scanning, where we have 3 engines that we scan all of your mail through. We use the 3 engines just to give that a little bit extra protection. One virus protector or one virus engine may have the definition just a little bit quicker than the next should an outbreak occur, so we do have the 3. One of the nice things in Exchange Online Protection is we have the ability now to strip out the attachment if there is a virus attached to it. So no longer do we just have the option of dropping that mail, but you have the ability to deliver the message on with the stripped attachment and let the end user know that that message contained some malicious content.
And we'll show you how that's configured later.
Absolutely. If everything looks clean there, we move forward with our policy enforcement. This is where the administrator can go in and put in some corporate policies. Maybe there are certain certain types of files you definitely don't want within your organization. Maybe there's other types of restrictions that you want to put in place. Allows and rejects were created there. There is also an option if you want to quarantine a message as it comes in for viewing later, that opportunity is there as well. Everything passes there just fine. It looks all fine and dandy. Moves forward into our spam protection layer. This is where we do some additional review of those messages. If you're using our directory sync tool, you can sync your block senders and your safe senders up, and so we will take a look at those at that level. Additional content scanning is happening in this area, as well as some bulk mail filtering. And if you've enabled some additional content filters, some advanced things like empty messages or
bad words
included in there, that will happen in this particular section. Depending on the action you want to have that have occur in that section, you can direct the messages that are unwanted into a spam quarantine. We'll tag it with an X header if you choose. We'll modify the subject line. We can even, for some customers, we can even direct it to the junk mail folder with some additional configuration. If you had attended the session yesterday afternoon with Ori and Tamara about what we do with your spam, you'll have heard about our spam analyst team. They're a very important part of our filtering service. They are there to help make sure if there is any immediate outbreaks, that they're on top of it, watching to see if there's anything that's going on. And they're always constantly updating the content scanning in that sense. Everything looks fine, passed all those checks, then it moves over into the corporate network and delivered on to you. Sometimes we may have miscategorized a message. We may have considered it spam incorrectly, or we may have not actually identified it as spam, and you or your users have decided that it should be spam. So there is a feedback mechanism to come back to us. That is using the junk reporting tool, and we'll talk a little bit more about that a little later. But that reporting goes back to our spam analysts, and again, they use that knowledge as well with some of the other trends that they see going on to help make sure that our filtering is as up-to-date as possible to keep us protected from, and you protected from, any outbreaks.
Do you want questions, Doreen?
Yeah. I was going to say, does anybody have any questions so far about what I've had to say? If you don't mind just running up to the mic real quick, you're close, so thanks.
I just thought it was interesting. Normally, customers are told to block their spam first before virus scanning. Why is there a difference there?
Well, what we try to do is we try to get the messages out of the message pipeline at our earliest opportunity. If you know that a message has a virus-infected payload, there's no reason to keep putting it through the rest of the filtering. And our spam filtering is actually third in the filtering pipeline. We do the antivirus first, and then the custom transport rules that are defined by the customers, and then the anti-spam check. And so we also want to be really sensitive to incorrectly categorizing messages. For enterprise business use, it's really important that you are very careful about it. But when we know it's infected, there's no reason to put it through any other processing. So that's why we do it first.
Great question. Thank you. Any other questions?
Go ahead. So coming from an on-site spam filtering, when we went to FOPI, the biggest question we get is why? Why did this get quarantined? And when you have it on-site, obviously you can go in, you can look at the, you know, SCL rating, or our previous one was that there it hit like a rule as far as bad message or bad words, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I understand the heuristics that you guys are using is proprietary, but even if there was like a general broad category that would help us identify or help the users identify, it definitely helped me that way. I can't give an explanation as to why it might have got quarantined.
So that's really great feedback, and we have heard that a couple of times this week. One of the things that I was talking to the team about as well, to the engineering team, is finding a way to give that type of information back to the user and or the admin. And so that is something that they are considering moving forward, is to help with some of that. As you say, there's some stuff we just can't tell you because it's proprietary to us, but we're going to try and give out as much information as we possibly can.
The balance is being able to provide you with enough information to answer the question, but not provide enough information to the spammers so that they can work around the system. And the spammers are extremely talented people, very smart. And so part of making it hard for them also ends up making it hard for everybody.
But that's good feedback. Thank you. If there are no other questions, we'll go ahead and start talking a little bit about outbound.
Oh, we have another question.
Oh, we have another question.
Okay. I am totally a neophyte when it comes to EOP or FOPP because we are on-prem.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But in a policy rule, is it possible to quarantine that on its own quarantine so we can see if the rule is effective or not and if it's catching the right things? I mean, do we have separate quarantines for different policies, or can we set up different quarantines, or can we search by a policy rule to see if it's catching the items we want to catch or not? Does that make sense?
It does. So there's in EOP, there is a, yeah, well, I don't think I have any messages in the quarantine. We can show you what it looks like. But you'd be able to do searches in the quarantine and get the results. But if you're going to test a rule, actually what I would recommend is that you use test, right? So that way you're not going to end up quarantining a message that you may later have to release. If you're not sure what the exact hit is going to be on that transport rule, we have test options that will tag an X header, and then you can monitor for that on your on-premises system and see what comes through.
Sometimes they'd rather us catch it and verify it and release it than catch and release, rather than just see that we missed it and we should have caught it.
Well, you can absolutely do that too. And so if you, for example, you've got a specific sender or a subject line that you want to quarantine, you'll be able to search for that in the quarantine as an administrator, and you'll be able to find those. Those messages will not be visible to end users. Our end user quarantine is coming, but that is for spam messages, not for policy. If the administrator has built a transport rule to send them to quarantine, then those are not currently user accessible.
Okay. Does any of this change for Office 365 customers?
So EOP is an Office 365 product. It is in front of Exchange Online. It is in front of on-premises customers, whether they're Exchange or not. The filtering logic, all of it's the same. It's all integrated.
Good question. Oh, we're getting lots of questions. Yay.
Hi, Don.
Hi. Is there a way to release multiple messages at once from the quarantine where you can select more than one?
Sort of. It's not through the UI, but in PowerShell, you can actually write a commandlet that will release all of the messages that match the criteria.
We have that in the deck a little bit later as well.
So you're working on... Okay, good.
There's a lot of functionality in PowerShell that is not bubbled up through the UI.
Any other questions?
Excellent questions.
Great questions. Thank you so much. Let's talk about outbound. Outbound's going to look very familiar. The only difference is that it's reversed from where you start. So we start with a corporate network. Your sender hits send on the message. It hits our network, and it starts with the virus scanning. Again, we have those same three virus engines that we were using on the mail as it was coming in and going out. Again, for the same reasons, want to make sure that you are protected. If the message is clean, there is no virus on that message, it then goes through policy enforcement. So again, this is where the administrator can say, I don't want this to go out of my network. This is where email encryption would happen as well. Again, there is the opportunity to have some of those messages quarantined as they go out of the organization to make sure that there's nothing being linked out of there. From there, we then do a little bit of spam protection. We do have some content scanning and some heuristics that happen. There is also some advanced capability that's listed that is there. The spam analysts are also important in this section, again, to help help you and help us to make sure that we're not sending spam out into the world. So there may be some actions that happen on your sent mail. If we see that an account may happen to be compromised, we may put restrictions on that account so that it doesn't continue to infect your organization and the rest of the network, and that would happen in that particular layer. Talking a little bit more about that, if the message is clean, there's no viruses, there's no concern messages, it goes out through a normal pool, what we consider our good pool. So all your business mail will end up going out through this nice green pipeline that goes out. If there's anything that we're a little bit curious about, and we're not quite sure on, pardon me, we'll send it through the higher risk pool. So the higher risk pool today is a big mash where everything goes through. We are currently releasing some distinct different pipelines in that higher risk pool. We have our higher risk delivery, so if there's spam messages that are happening to go out through our network, we'll send them through that particular pool. We're building out, if there happens to be bulk mail that comes through, though we don't recommend using EOP for sending bulk mail, if there does happen to be bulk mail going through, that will end up with its own separate pipeline. And then as well as any NDRs, if there are any NDRs that are going out through the service, those will also have its own separate pool moving forward so that it makes the delivery a little bit easier on the sender or on the recipient.
And these are all an effort for us to protect the IPs of the service so that anybody who's sending good mail doesn't have to worry about those IPs being blocked. So whenever we run across a message that we're just not 100% confident that it is a good piece of mail, we just deliver it through these other IPs. They are more frequently on block lists. That's kind of their goal in life. They take one for the team and try to protect everybody else's email. And it's an evolving strategy, but it's been pretty effective so far.
Absolutely. Any questions on outbound? Sure, come on up to the mic.
Does that mean we have a requirement to use EOP as a smart host?
It is not a requirement. If you want to relay outbound from your own server to the internet, you're absolutely able to do so.
So one other question. Something you said was like we put some restrictions. Can you elaborate on the restrictions that you put when you find suspicious emails and such things as bulk emails? If you're relaying, you've got applications that's sending out bulk emails. How do you react to that?
So the restrictions are more around the volume that is sent out and the type of message, right? So there's two different things, and I'm speaking mostly in the context of spam emails. So we put restrictions in, and I don't have the exact number, but if you're sending too much spam email out, we'll actually prevent that mailbox and that sender from moving forward with sending spam. We have ways of contacting you to let you know so that it's not all of a sudden the user's like, why can't I send mail?
And Wendy
will show you that as we move forward.
I think that is similar to my question. Is when you're getting higher risk, when your scores are going up for messages, When do we know about that? Or is there a way for us to find out, like, oh, you're using the high risk? Like, if I wanted to go look and find out if we're using the high risk pools more often than we should, is there a way for us to figure that out, or do we have to wait for you to contact us? Or
we have ways, and we'll go over that.
Good question, though.
Yep, good question.
Hey, two questions. How likely is it that any of your outbound pools could be listed as on a blacklist? And if so, how quickly does that get remediated?
So the higher risk delivery pool, like I mentioned, it's frequently blacklisted.
There's a good chance that
there's a good chance that those messages are gonna be.
Those IPs will be on a block list for sure.
But we do have relationships with most of the really big IP reputation providers so that we monitor with them. We have open dialogue with them so that if we find that our reputation is slipping, we can proactively get things resolved on our end prior to being blocked. If it does come to being put on a block list from one of our good IPs, then as soon as we're notified about that, it's got to be a pretty big block list. But depending on the impact, we will reach out to the block list providers to find out specifically what was it that resulted in us being put on the block list and what remediations do we have to do in order to get that lifted and how soon can that possibly happen. It's basically an emergency in the service when we end up on one of the major block lists.
And we do work as quickly as we possibly can to get it resolved because it does not only impact one individual customer but our entire service. And so.
we don't want that to happen.
Part of the challenge is that there's, you know, 1,000 different IP block list reputation builders, and we don't have existing relationships with all of them, but with the major players, we definitely do.
Yeah. My other question was, if we have certain third parties that we need to maintain TLS connections with end-to-end, is that easily configured with Poppy?
Yes, it is. Yeah, TLS connections are very easy. Both our inbound and outbound connectors within the service have options for TLS. And we'll go through that, and I'll show you what those options are.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good questions.
We've run into a couple of very large customers, like colleges or 4,000 or 5,000 users that have gone to EOP, Office 365, and they periodically send out, it's not spam, but email to their constituents or users, which might be, you know, 5, 10, 15,000 emails that they need to blast out. And you said you don't recommend them going through EOP. What do we do with those? I mean, how, because they have a smart relay, we're handing all their mail to Office 365. What are the options?
So the recommendation to not send bulk email is really things more aligned with like newsletters, advertisements, things like that. We definitely have customers who have a legitimate need to send, especially universities, a broad communication to several hundred thousand people all at the same time. We do have the ability to take specific addresses and escalate those requests to get them to get their sending limits modified. In general, especially if they're sending from an on-premises system into the cloud, we haven't had too many problems. If it's a cloud mailbox trying to send out, there are different thresholds that impact their ability to send large messages, but if they use distribution groups, then that'll mitigate a lot of that. So if you find that you've got this sending address that you know is going to be sending 300,000 messages in a single day, you may want to contact support and see, you know, if there's anything you need to do.
We're also building in some intelligence around customer mail flow going out through the service. Businesses have a natural pattern of their of communication, right? If there is certain communications that need to go out to their community, hundreds of thousands of messages about a particular security threat or registration in the case of a college, things like that. They tend to be predictable, and we're working on building in some of that intelligence moving forward to help with some of that as well. But the tactics that Wendy talked about are certainly the most effective that we have today.
Today.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand the
I'm not sure that I understand the question either, and I want to make sure that we've got time to dig into it. So perhaps we can table that for the end if you don't mind, and we'll come back to it. I think that's a very valuable question. I want to make sure I fully understand.
Okay, one last question about that, about your saying about the patterns.
Mm-hmm.
We use a service called Rave, as a lot of universities do, or other emergency communications things where they can send by text, but email is the default. Those are going to be out of pattern, and it's from a known service provider. Is there any way to get them prioritized so that they could send to our 60,000 users or whatever quickly, because it's usually for an emergency situation, a delay is not really acceptable there?
Well, so we don't have priority delivery. What I would recommend is if you have an external sender that you want to make sure those messages are getting through as quickly as possible,
yeah.
Set up a transport rule
okay.
that would look for messages from the specific senders that they're going to be using to communicate to your end users and bypass spam filtering on it.
Yeah,
right?
We do that, and we actually do that for stuff from on campus as well, stuff from our on campus.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if there was another way to do that.
Our mail delivery SLA is 1 minute.
Okay.
Right. So
okay, cool.
We haven't had a need to really prioritize mail delivery okay. because it's really fast generally anyway.
Okay. Mm-hmm. If we notice problems, like we run tests every once in a while, if we notice any problems, is there a way that we can identify those for you and say, look, in this situation we're in a test and you can see delivery across these test accounts is not within that SLA? And I don't know that we've had that problem, but that is something that our director wants yeah. to have. And like, yes, I've done this because it's part of our auditing thing.
Yep.
For so.
I encourage you to test it,
okay.
right? And if you see that it's taking longer than a minute, then escalate it.
Okay.
It is most likely a transient issue, right?
Yeah.
There may have been a problem with one of the servers in the mail relay.
Okay.
If you notice it to be consistent, absolutely let
okay.
us know, but
awesome.
I would be very surprised.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Good questions. Any other questions?
So the question is, if he had a message that was being sent from a domain not provisioned in FOPI, and it was being identified as a spam message, so it was going outbound through the higher risk delivery pool.
Right.
So,
right.
But the unapproved domain shouldn't make it go through the higher risk
yeah,
delivery
does.
Pool.
Yeah, it does. We'll have to talk about that. Okay. I'm not sure about the design in EOP. I know that is a design in FOPI.
So, okay, we have a different understanding, which is okay. We'll sort it out later. the answer is no, though. In order to track a message, you have to have permission to view either the sender domain or the recipient domain. And if you don't have permission to view either one, then you don't have permission to track that message. Because otherwise there would be no way to stop you from tracking some other customer's message. And so if you're sending from, you know, the on-premises system and it's getting relayed through and you're seeing it hand off to EOP and then you're losing it, you can always open up a support ticket, and support has access to all of the logs and support will be able to help you. But there's not going to be a mechanism for us to be able to allow you to view that message because of the security boundaries.
Good answer. All right, any other questions? Excellent. I'm going to hand it over to Wendy to talk about some deployment and configuration stuff for you.
So there's basically three different flavors of EOP. We touched on this a little bit earlier. We've got EOP standalone, which is just EOP purchased for your on-premises systems, whatever those are, and you don't have any other Office 365 services. You can also get EOP as part of the eCal with services licenses. That gives you access to things like encryption and DLP. If you have Exchange Online, then you also have EOP in front of Exchange Online. All of the administrative toggles and settings that we're going to talk about apply to every EOP. The logic is consistent throughout the entire, all of the different offerings. In Exchange Online, there's a couple of different ways you can be set up too. You can have fully hosted, mailboxes, you can have hybrid mailboxes, and with hybrid you have a whole bunch of extra complexity added, but it's all still part of the filtering pipeline. When you're going to first sign up for EOP, you want to make sure that you have gone through a plan for it. It's the same as onboarding to anything new. You want to make sure that you know what your prerequisites are going to be. Make sure that you know what the IPs are that need to be locked down on your firewalls. Make sure that you have got good connectivity between the online service and your on-premises system. You want to configure those mail flow connectors so that we're getting the information from your on-premises servers into EOP and they can be correctly attributed to your tenant. Your domains have to be present. If you want users populated, the users should be present. Once you've got that all set up, well, I guess you would have to add and validate the domains before you add the users, but except for that. you can go in and customize your spam and policy settings, the transport rules, set them up the way you want it, do some testing. We recommend that you test with a non-production domain. If you've got a subdomain or a test domain that's dedicated, that you have an environment, you can use that domain to make sure that things are working the way you want them. Then you swing your MX record over, and that will enable mail flow through the service. After the mail starts coming through, you're going to want to make sure that you understand what's happening. If you've got your spam action set to junk mail folder and your non-premises mailbox, well, those messages are not going to get sent to the junk mail folder if you don't have the transport rules on your on-premises system that are monitoring for the headers that say go to the junk mail folder. So you just want to make sure that the behavior you were intending to get is the behavior you actually got. These apply to all different scenarios. It doesn't matter whether you're EOP standalone or the eCal with services or Exchange Online with hybrid. The connectivity settings, they all have to be they all have to make sure that you're going to be able to get that mail flow through. When you sign up for Office 365, you'll pick your own on Microsoft.com domain, and everybody gets that. That's called what we call the tenant domain name, and so that'll be the initial domain. After you've added your actual domains, you can change that to be the default domain. Otherwise, the onmicrosoft.com just acts as the default domain. You want to make sure that you have the right licenses applied. It is not necessary for EOP to assign EOP licenses to users, but for Exchange Online it is. It looks like we have a question.
Wendy, it's really more of a request. From an EOP hybrid, we do a lot of deployments for CDW. One of the challenges we run into is, to your point on the previous slide, is we have blacklisting IP addresses when we do a hybrid deployment. And it's very difficult to find out that they are blacklisted unless you do an SMTP telnet to EOP. And that is not really well known. So if there's a feature set that EOP can work on to show, because FOPI was very good at showing you that tracking when it was blocked.
Yep.
EOP does not. So hopefully EOP is going to allow some facilitation of troubleshooting that.
So is what you're saying is when you set up an IP address as your on-premises IP,
correct.
In FOPI, you got better notification that it was...
So when you set up a hybrid deployment, set up your inbound-outbound connectors, right? Outbound to your on-premise environment, sometimes when you do test mail flow, you get no notification that it was blocked. It just says failure, okay? The only way that you can find out that you're blocked is if you're going from on-prem and telnet to EOP, which is very problematic because you have to do a specific string to EOP and then do your telnet command, say hello. It'll say, sorry, you've been blacklisted at such and such black house or spam house. If there is a way for us to track the infopy, you could see it. Hey, you've been rejected because of XYZ.
Yeah.
EOP does not facilitate that. So the logging and the tracking purposes to troubleshoot that is very difficult to do unless you specifically know to telnet to EOP. So
I have heard that feedback before. Thank you. Thank you for bringing it back again. It just brought it back top of mind for me, and I'm sure my colleague that's sitting over here. That's very good feedback. It is something that I've seen before as well, especially if somebody gets a new IP address that has started with a bad reputation. We
I'll admit, we're not as good at cleaning up if you've had a bad reputation. If you've got a bad reputation, in some cases, you stay with that bad reputation, whether it was yours to begin with or not. And so that's great feedback. I really appreciate that. And I did make a note as well that we can build it into our tools, but also have that we got feedback that we should check our reputation of the IP addresses every once in a while to make sure they're clean. Thank you.
So I just want to ask a question. So my understanding is that if you send a message and you're on the block list, you should be getting a return code just the same as you got in FOPI that tells you why you're blocked. Is that not?
No, that should still be the same.
The start TLS is a little different, right? Because that wasn't, that's not prohibiting the connection, right? That's just prohibiting TLS, right? What he's, right. The start TLS fails, and that is what's causing the messages to then go into deferral because, yeah, okay, so got that. Thank you.
That was a good one. Thank you.
So these are just some of the other prerequisites. You need to have a domain to put into the service. The modern web browser, we support lots of them. The Office 365 portal is the portal that we use for EOP. So anything that's supported there is also supported for us. The settings that you need just for an on-premises system, you need to be aware of what your inbound and outbound IP addresses are, and you need to make sure that you've got your firewalls open to the EOP IPs. You want to know what TLS requirements you have, if you're going to be able to run the hybrid wizard, if you have partners that you need to be able to establish TLS connections to, and then if you want to set up DirSync to Office 365, there are some good reasons to do so. The automatic synchronization of your users will take their safe and block lists from their on-premises Active Directory objects and push them to the cloud. And then also you'd have an automatic way to be able to use the directory-based edge blocking. So the Office 365 portal, I've got a little screenshot here of what the different UIs look like. They are a little different depending on how you are subscribed to EOP. What we've done in 2013 is we've made the EAC more consistent across Office 365 and Exchange on-premises. So you can see the backmost picture is the Exchange Server 2013 administrative console. The middle one is Exchange Online, and EOP standalone has, you know, fewer options, and in the Exchange Online one, you can see all of the other suite products in there as well. So in order to configure mail flow between your on-premises system and EOP, there are fundamentally four connectors that we have to have. You have to have a send connector from your on-premises system into the service, an inbound connector that comes into EOP to accept those messages from your on-premises system, an outbound connector that goes out from EOP back to your on-premises system, and then a receive connector within on your on-premises system. Those connectors can be secured with TLS, and there are different thresholds that you can set. They can be scoped to specific domains. We'll go through some of those options in the demo. Hybrid is really best configured using the hybrid config wizard. If you can run it, it simplifies things a lot. I don't know. I don't know. I worked on the 2010 SP2 hybrid config wizard, and I had no idea how helpful it was going to be. All I did was the mail flow parts. I just made sure that that little bit would work, and I went through and learned what all of the requirements were that the wizard was taking care of, and I was just like, this is the best thing ever. I was so happy I was able to do my little bit. The mail flow is this much. Hybrid is this much. If you can use the wizard, it's super helpful. And then, again, with the connectors, you can set up partnerships with other companies. If you want to deliver to a specific set of IPs instead of what they have listed as their MX record, you can do that with outbound connectors. If you want to make sure that their connections to you are always going to use a TLS certificate, you can set up an inbound connector for your partner. That just helps both sides to be able to ensure that that connection is always going to be encrypted as the messages are going across the SMTP. Any questions on this? So the Mailflow connectors. Like I said, we have these inbound and outbound connectors that we need into and out of the service. I do agree they're a little confusing. Just try to think about the naming as if the hub is the middle, right? So we've got the service here. Your inbound connection is into the service, and then outbound is out of the service. So when the message comes outbound from your mail server, it'll go through the send connector, and that still makes sense. And then it'll come into the inbound connector, into the service, and then it'll deliver out to the internet. So it is an outbound, an inbound, and then out again. And the same for mail coming from the internet, comes into the service, and then it'll follow an outbound connector to go to the receive connector on your on-premises system. So the directionality naming of the connector is specific to the exchange system on-premises and the exchange system in the cloud. We are doing some work in the connectors wizard to make that easier to figure out exactly what the connectors do. But if you just kind of shift where the target is for that particular connector, it'll make a little more sense. It's easily confusing. Sorry. And when you want to set up a connector to a partner, it's a little less confusing. Because then you're not the, it's an outbound message to the partner from your system, outbound connector. Inbound message from the partner to your system, inbound connector. That one works a lot better. You can create a bunch of different settings with the connectors, and we'll go through what those options are. The other thing that we get in EOP is if you have a multi-company organization and you've got different data centers, you've got one in APAC and you've got one in LATAM and you've got one in EMEA. If you want to be able to take the mail all in through EOP and then deliver those messages specifically to the regions where those mailboxes live, you can set up what's called criteria-based routing. And that is a special connector that will deliver according to a transport rule that is configured. So you set up that connector with your own domain namespace, and it will be configured to deliver to LATAM. And then you set up a group that has all the mailboxes in it, or the mail users in it, that need to deliver to that region. Set up a transport rule to use that group or to use an attribute on those users, and then it will route through that connector, and then those guys will get their regional delivery. It is going to take all the different SMTP addresses for those users. It will apply because it'll resolve on the user, and then it'll deliver through that connector. It is, I don't know if you had to do this intelligent routing in FOPI, anybody. This is way better, way easier to manage. Go ahead.
With regard to that routing on the previous slide, can you control percentage of mail flow to one or the other, or is it?
It is not based on that. These are different destinations, right? So it's not, we wouldn't be able to take 20% of the messages and deliver it to North America and 20% and send it to LATAM. What if you do want to use weighted delivery? So I'll go over this in the connector demo, but you do have the ability to define specific IP addresses to use for a connector. And those IP addresses will just be used round robin right now. If you want to weight them so that you've got like a 10 and a 20 and a 30, then what we recommend is that you use a DNS name. And so you just put the DNS name in there, and then you control the weighting on the back end.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So part of this, adding your domains into Office 365, we had this concept in FOPI as well. You have to add the domain, then you have to prove ownership of it. And what we give you in Office 365 is a little text record that you can add to your DNS, and then it'll validate the domain. Once the domain is validated, it's active for service. There are other steps that you can go through, but the domain validation step is what actually enables it for the service. So as soon as you've got that domain validated, you can go into the EAC, and you will be able to see that domain in EOP or in Exchange Online. You'll be able to add users in Office 365 using that domain just at the validation step. There's another step that we go through in Office 365 to confirm what the intent of the domain is. For exchange purposes, that is not actually necessary in order to use the domain. The validation for the EOP customers, frequently you'll see setup in progress because what you needed is validated domains in order to use it. The setup in progress, you can get through that step, but it really is designed for hosted domains. And so one of the requirements to get past that step is that your MX record has to point to Office 365. Well, if you're delivering on-prem and you're setting up your domain and you don't have your users, that's not where your MX record is going to point yet. So you're not going to be able to get through that. Auto-discover has to be pointed to Office 365. Again, if you're on-premises, that's not where auto-discover needs to point. So one of the helpful things we get is your SPF record, but there are additional requirements for on-premises customers. You want to make sure that if you're sending outbound messages, your outbound IPs are also listed in your SPF record, because the SPF check, there's a bunch of different people who can crawl IPs, and they're looking past the service IPs, and they need to get to your IP. So your SPF record, if you have on-prem systems that you're sending outbound, should include your on-prem IPs. So the setup in progress is just not a big deal. We're working on getting that experience fixed so that there's more intelligence in it, so that they can determine if they're an on-premises customer first. But right now, it's just okay to leave it like that. Yeah, if you have a question. So the question is, if you're being migrated from FOPI to EOP, do you have to revalidate? The answer is no. The migration process will add and validate the domains for you. Any domain that you have validated in FOPI is good to go. The domain validation also existed in FOPI, which is why we are able to grandfather it in. So the spam action settings and the company policies, I'll go through the demo and show you what all the UI looks like and talk through all of these different settings, and that will be more interesting than the slide. Oh, now. I don't know, actually. We have 45 more minutes. We don't have a timer going.
We don't have a timer. That's what I was asking.
So we'll try to keep an eye on the time. So I'll talk faster.
Okay.
This is the Office 365 portal. When you log in, you've got this dashboard, and this is a pre-release environment. It's not that the service health dashboard is broken for Office 365. It's just not here. But you just go here, and then you'll choose. If you have Exchange Online Protection only, then what you'll have in this drop-down is Office 365 and Exchange Online Protection. If you have Exchange Online, whether you're hybrid or fully hosted, you'll have Exchange. Let's see if it kept me logged in.
Fingers crossed.
Yes. Okay. So inside of the Exchange Admin Center, or the EAC, is where we set up our policies. There's a default policy for anti-malware, which is configured, and you can take a look at that, and you can change the settings if you want to. The default action is to drop the message, right? If you have a virus that has been detected, we just drop the message. If you don't want to drop the message and you want to strip the attachment, then you have some other options. You can delete the attachment and use a default alert text, which just tells the recipient that they received a message that was identified as infected. Or you can customize the text that you send to them. So you can tell them something more targeted about that message stripping. But with that, they'll get the full message headers. They'll get, you know, who it was from, what the subject line was, who the intended recipient was, when it was, so that if it's a legitimate message that they had intended to receive, they have enough information to go back to the person who sent it and say, could you check your Excel file before you send it, because it looked like it had something bad in it. You also have the ability to notify senders if they are sending an attachment or a virus-infected message. So the top section takes care of the recipient. The bottom section is if you want to just tell your own mailbox senders, the internal users, that they have sent something out that's bad, you can do that. If you want to notify external senders that they're sending a virus-infected message, you can do that. We generally don't recommend that because most virus senders aren't humans. And so telling them that they have sent you an infected message is really just increasing the backscatter on the internet. You can also configure notifications to go to administrators if they want to if you want to have them alerted that there is a that was a virus infected message that was sent through. But most of our customers just look at the reports. The reports will, especially if you're using the workbook. In EOP, we have this Excel 2013 workbook that actually calls out to our reporting APIs and pulls down a ton of beautiful data. You get so much more information in that workbook than we ever had in FOPI. It is amazing. But you'll be able to see sender, recipient, subject line. You'll be able to see the date. I mean, there's message ID. I mean, there's tons and tons of information in the report. So the connection filter, if you think about the way the messages come through the message pipeline, connection filter actually manages the network perimeter. So if you want to safe list IPs or block list IPs, that actually takes place at the network perimeter. So that's our connection filter. So if you have messages that you want to make sure are coming from a trusted party and they're never going to be spam scanned, then you want to put those IPs in your always accept list. And that'll stamp the SCL on those messages as -1, and it'll skip spam scanning so that you would be able to get those messages delivered through, and you don't have to do anything else. If you want to safe list messages from an IP, but you also want to make sure that any messages from that IP and a different domain is not having the ability to skip spam scanning, then you can combine this with a transport rule that will actually look at the messages from the same IP and set the SCL to 0 unless the sender is one of your trusted domain partner domain names. And SCL 0 in the transport rule will tell the spam engine, I need to look at this message. And so then the spam filter will process that message and apply all the regular spam rules to it. I think this is a great feature. The ability to safe list conditionally, I think, is really very helpful. Question? So you should be able to do search through PowerShell. If you connect to PowerShell, then you'd be able to search it that way. I'm sorry, I can't hear.
I heard the question.
Okay.
He wants to know if there's ability to add a note to the IP address that you add, and when you like for when you added or why you added it.
So not in this UI, but that's great feedback. What you can do on a transport rule is if you have that transport rule where you're allowing just that partner's domain names, there's a description area on the transport rule where you could track that. But there's no notes place in this particular view. That's great feedback, though. So the transport rule cannot be applied until after the message has been accepted into the network. And so that's why the connection filter is so important. If this IP address is on one of our block lists, then it's never going to make it to the transport rule. And so the connection, the same is for domains, right? We've got the domain allow list here.
No?
Is that the other place?
No, just IPs.
Yeah, these are IPs. So if you have to have the messages coming in, it has to be here. This is the only way to override the block list. If they're not on a block list, then the transport rules are fine because they were able to get through the network perimeter. It's not a problem. Then those actions can be taken. It's actually not necessary usually to put a whole bunch of IPs on this list because most people don't end up on the block list unless they've been actually sending bad mail. Especially our list is built using the spam logic that we use internally. So it is really for those super high risk partners, or for, you know, emergency critical mail that you just want to absolutely make sure there's no ability for it to get IP blocked. So the content filter, this content filter is where you specify what your spam action is going to be. So we have a bunch of different options. And in EOP, we now can have different actions based on how spammy the message is. So if the message is high confidence spam, which basically means we know darn sure that that's a spam message, then you can choose to do a different action, like delete, which we didn't have in FOPI. The other actions are just that you can do them on whether that's high confidence or regular spam. Move the messages to the junk mail folder. If it's an Exchange Online mailbox that already has the transport rules logic in place in order to route that message to the junk mail folder, we have guidance for setting up the transport rules on your on-premises server to route those to the junk mail folder based on the SCL in here. Add an X header if you have a non-Exchange system. Or you just want to be able to track the messages for a different reason, you can add an X header to the messages. And prepend the subject line with text. We don't see a lot of people doing that because, you know, if you put spam in the front of a message, it's not that much difference. It doesn't impact the delivery. It just allows you to build tracking on your on-premises system. Redirect the messages to an email address. If you're going to do that, make sure it's a big mailbox. Delete the message or send it to the quarantine. Spam messages that are sent to the quarantine, you can configure spam notifications to go to the end users. You can set between 1 and 14 days delivery. The messages will sit there for 15 days before they're automatically deleted, so you don't have to clean that up. A question? Pardon me? Is there... So the question is there a way to control the exact time that the notification is sent out? And the answer is no. So the process across the entire service kicks off at the beginning of the day, right? And it'll just go through all the notifications it needs to send that day. Yes, so the question is about the portal. Right now, the quarantine portal is accessible to the administrators only. And in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be releasing that for end users. And it will not be exactly the same as it was in FOPI, but they'll be able to search based on, you know, sender, recipient, subject, and they'll be able to release the messages that way. They can release the messages from the spam notification if you have that enabled. One of the things about the spam quarantine is they will have to have the ability to log on, which means they'll have to have an Office 365 user account, just like they had to have in FOPI. They had to have a FOPI account to be able to access the spam quarantine. The benefit of the EOP system is the administrator no longer has to create an account just to find somebody else's spam mail, right? They can do a search without having their accounts populated and still be able to find them. The EOP license is fine. A mail user can have a license. They don't have to have an Exchange Online mailbox or anything. They just have to have a mail user that is licensed.
A SAML plugin?
SAML. I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either.
I have a question just real quick before you go off the screen.
Sure.
The one of the actions is move message to junk email folder. What we made the assumption, probably wrong, but one of the other actions is to just add an X header.
Mm-hmm.
We felt that meant don't move to junk mail folder.
Well, so the X header, it doesn't do anything unless you tell it to take action based on the X header.
Right. So by excluding, like by not selecting with the junk mail folder, we felt nothing would go to the junk mail folder that met that criteria.
Okay, so there's two things that actually result in mail going to the junk mail folder. One of them is the spam score that is set by the service. The other is Outlook doing its own thing. right? So when Outlook takes a message and it sends it to the junk mail folder, it's very helpful and it tells you this message was sent to the junk mail folder by Outlook. But Outlook does not always apply the same logic that we do. So if we identified a message that was junk and the Outlook client also identifies that message as junk, even if you're telling us to just add an X header, Outlook can still put it in the junk mail folder.
I think that's very similar as well as what the lady was asking question. Earlier. As I've been sitting here processing the question, I think it's very similar.
Yeah, so we saw that in OWA too. So,
yeah.
So I guess my question is it working as designed if I set it to just add an X header and the spam score is still 6, let's say, it's going to go to a junk mail folder, even if I'm not running Outlook? Right, because I've had different answers on this from Microsoft.
Yeah, the answer you get from me is I'm not sure. I'll have to follow up and find out. I don't know what the behavior would be. I know what it is with Outlook. With OWA, I would have not expected that, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, we were just doing some testing.
Yeah.
We were saying, like, okay, maybe we can just say, you know, just add an X header so we can track the message.
Sure.
That this would have been detected as spam, but it went straight to the junk mail folder. Which, you know, if that's working as designed, then that's good. I just need to understand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
what's the design?
Oh, my name tag's not on. Wendy.Wilkes@Microsoft.com. If you send me email, I will find out what the answer to that behavior question is and get it back to you. So there are a bunch of advanced options that you can choose to. Most of them are not enabled by default, the exception being the block all bulk messages is on by default. But you just take a look at these and figure out which ones apply to your service. So outbound spam, I said I would talk about this. I'll talk fast. This is where you can set up the notification. So if we find somebody that is sending mail outbound through your service, through your server, and they're sending from your own domains, then we can send a notification to you we'll BCC you on the message so that you get a copy of that message that we are saying is spam. The thing to watch out for, especially in a larger organization, one of the gentlemen, I think he's in here today, but he was, yeah, getting 50,000 messages a day in that mailbox is a little not helpful. So what I recommend is that you turn it on while you're actively investigating something, and then when you've identified what the problem is, then you can turn it off again. Otherwise, it's just going to be noise, and you don't really want to just have a bunch of noise. You will have reporting where you can see your sent spam, and you'll be able to see what your general trends are, and you'll be able to identify a spike in the regular outbound spam sending patterns. And then this is where you would send a notification if a sender is actually blocked for sending too many messages or sending spam. If they get blocked, then this is the way that we know who to contact to tell you that your user's been blocked. So this is really important that you fill it out.
We will be coming up actually over the next little while with also notifications within the message center for that outbound traffic as well. So just watch for notification on that.
Okay. So this is what the spam notification looks like. When a user gets it, they'll be able to release to the inbox, or they'll be able to report the message as not junk if it's incorrectly identified as junk. That report is not junk will release the message to the end user and also send a copy of that message to our spam analyst team so that they can review our rules to see if they need to be adjusted. Okay, so here's the two rules that you would need on premises in order to take the messages and apply them, move into junk for your on premises mailboxes. I put the mouse. Sometimes end users need to be educated on the use of the junk mail folder. A lot of people, I work with a lot of people who don't even look at it. I've been doing email for a very long time. I always look at it. False positives happen. Business critical email can be incorrectly identified as spam. We try to lean the other way so that we're going to let a little bit more through rather than be super aggressive about marking it as spam. But the junk mail folder, it should not, I don't believe it should be completely ignored.
I agree. Occasionally I find something there and go, oh, hey, I knew that.
Oh, I did want to go to that concert.
Yeah.
So in order to enable mail flow, then you're going to just change the MX record. Every domain has its own little MX record suggestion in EOP. The SPF record is listed here. Again, this is for the fully hosted domains. So if you have on-premises IPs that you're going to be delivering from, either through the service or externally not using the service, then I'd encourage you to get those IPs added to that SPF record. You don't have to change your CNAME DNS entries. You just, that text record is all you need to get that validated. Create the smart host to route to EOP if you want to use EOP for outbound. Like I said earlier, it is not required. And then your firewalls, you do want to lock those down if you're going to be exclusively routing your mail through EOP, just because anybody not using your MX record who knows what your IP addresses are is going to be able to still connect to those servers and send spam through. And if you report that spam to our spam analyst team, they have to ignore it because it didn't go through the service, and so we don't have the information that we need in order to figure out which rules it would have hit because it just didn't go through the service. All right, let's see. Mail flow tab. All right, this will be fast, I promise. How are we? We got 10 minutes. Where's my mouse?
And the mouse is gone.
So in the mail flow tab, this is where you'd set up your transport rules. And the transport rules are so cool. So what they are is they're now a lot more like the rules wizard in Outlook. They, you've got all these nice wizards and menus, and we've got, you want to be able to bypass spam filtering? Sure, no problem. Where did my mouse go? Am I a touch screen? No.
Nope.
So you want to set if the sender domain is and add the little plus, say okay. And then this part is all filled in for you, set the SCL to bypass spam filtering, and then save it. It's really easy. The other thing that we get in EOP that we didn't have in FOPI is the ability to customize the order that the rules are processed in. Just like in Outlook, you can bump more rules up and stop processing rules so you don't get the same rule hitting more than one thing. You can do that here too. So if I want to bypass spam filtering and I really want to make sure that that is going to be, yeah, little replication. If you can set the priority to zero. Zero is the highest order. It's the first one to hit. You hit save, and then it'll go ahead and sort that to the top of the list. And so it's really easy to see what the order is going to be. In PowerShell, if you need to adjust a bunch of them, you can do it in PowerShell. If you just want to bump up a new rule up to a specific number, it's just as easy as that. I'm going to jump to the connectors. So this is an inbound connector that I've configured for forcing TLS with a business partner. I was able to set it up to use force TLS. I didn't have to specify their certificate name. I could just use their domain name, and then it's good to go. If you have IPs that you want to restrict mail delivery for that domain to those IPs, the connectors can do that too. If you have the messages coming from on-premises, then it's a different type of connector. It looks very similar. But what it does is it treats the messages a little bit differently and gives you the ability to retain the service headers. And the service headers are necessary for rich coexistence between Exchange on-premises and Exchange Online. But even without rich coexistence, if you have on-premises mailboxes that would be sending mail with a mixture of online mailboxes, you're going to want to make sure you have that on-premises connector configured so that your mail flow is trusted and attributed to the right direction. Again, force TLS is an option. Opportunistic is the default. And this is I set up a criteria-based connector, right, so that we can deliver mail to that host name where I would control the IPs that are on that host name. And the security on that is a publicly known cert. I know that was super fast. I'm sorry. Any questions? Okay. We
talked a little bit earlier about monitoring and fine-tuning. So just make sure that the way you intended things to work is the way they're working. That was a perfect example of we expected not to go to junk and they were going to junk. So when you don't get the behavior that you were anticipating, let us know. We can help you figure out what the settings are that need to be adjusted. We've got great reporting. The APIs that we have for the Excel spreadsheet that I was talking about earlier, they're public, so if you want to actually write your own custom reports and use those APIs, you can do so. And so it gives you a lot more flexibility in what reporting data you get. A question?
Are those reports set up on an automated schedule, so you can go in as an admin and get them sent to you?
We don't have the scheduled delivery reports at this point, but you can go in and pull them on demand. And the Excel report, you can probably schedule that. I mean, if you can get PowerShell to kick off the Excel report, the workbook. But on demand, it's pretty responsive. It calls in and the Excel report, I ran it against a domain that was getting about, or a tenant that was getting about 2 million messages a day. It took about 3 minutes to pull all the data in the workbook. Question? Yeah. So the statement was the scheduled reports in FOPI were awesome. Please bring them back. Yeah, got it.
Anya wrote it down.
We have tools for submitting spam. There's a junk mail plugin, or the Outlook plugin, that so users can just right-click on the message, and one of the junk options is report as spam, and then what it does is it packages up the message, sends it straight to the spam team, and that way we're ensured that all of the headers we need in order to do the spam rules analysis are present. Great tool, very helpful. We also have the ability to report junk in OWA. For the service and for on-premises. This is what our reports look like. We have these charts. We don't have the pie charts anymore, but we do have some graphs. Best practices. You have 4 minutes. Sorry.
All right. So some best practices. Wendy actually talked about a lot of them. You want to make sure that if you're just starting out with the service, we do recommend using a test domain, a subdomain, or a low-volume domain. I like the low-volume domain myself just simply because it's your own mail and you can see how the service is reacting to your own specific mail. Test mail tends to be not too indicative depending on the type of test mail that you're using. But we definitely do recommend that, especially if you're going to try out certain features just to see how they react. You definitely want to make sure you create those O365 connectors before adding the domains. We do have a remote connectivity analyzer tool that you can use. There's great functionality within there. You can test our connections to your service or to your on-premises servers to make sure that we can actually deliver and reach your servers and deliver that mail. We also have a header analyzer tool in there. If you want to figure out sort of what happened to that message, you can certainly just pop the headers in there and we'll parse it out for you and let you know what happened, which is really awesome as well. As Wendy said, you want to make sure that you are restricting your traffic to be just from us if you can, just again, to prevent any direct attacks to your service. Some things to keep in mind that we don't recommend daisy chaining services. So if you want to use us with another appliance or another service, it just introduces additional complexity in trying to troubleshoot what happened to that mail. Where do you look? It adds too many hops. Where does it go first? It's just, again, added complexity. We don't recommend using EOP for sending bulk mail. So if you do have a business need to send out that bulk mail, we just recommend it goes directly out to the internet rather than through us. We also don't recommend enabling all of the content filter advanced options right off the hop. Those are aggressive settings, and so there is very likely going to be false positives that you're introducing into your mail environment. So be very selective. Look at the monitoring as you're monitoring and fine-tuning. Figure out what it is that's actually happening to your mail, what's coming through. Enable them in test mode to start with for a little bit. Watch what's going on, and then enable them one at a time rather than all at once.
We also recommend enabling directory synchronization. This allows you some automated user and group management. You can create some transport rules based off of your AD groups as well. And the other nice feature is it allows you to bring over your end users, safe senders and block senders as well, so that they can feel a sense of ownership in that as well, that they've told us how they want the service to work. Yes. Yeah,
safeless aggregation.
Yes. We've also recently enabled directory-based edge blocking. This is what we had in FOPI, and we're now bringing it over into EOP. Great tool to allow you to take your user list, put it at our edge, and then we will only accept mail for those valid users. We don't actually have to worry about all the extra directory tags potentially and processing that mail. So I personally, and I know Wendy personally, highly recommends using this feature.
So if the mail is coming to the network for an invalid recipient, then they get a rejection right in the SMTP connection that tells them that access is denied. They can't. We don't say that the recipient doesn't exist. We say they are not allowed to send. It's not much obfuscation, but it's something.
A little bit. Excellent. Some things to keep in mind when you're migrating over from another service or appliance, a third party to EOP. Depending on how long you've had that service in place or that appliance in place, it's taken you a long time to set up that configuration. Our product works a little bit differently and our service works a little bit differently than some of the other stuff that's out there. So you want to take that time. It's not going to be perfect right out of the box, I'll be honest, and it will take a little bit of finesse in order to get it to function directly as you need it to. But this is also a good opportunity. It's kind of like moving. Gives you a chance to do some house cleaning. Take a look and see. There's a good opportunity to trim some of those lists. In that other service, in the other appliance, you were probably reacting to certain events that occurred. Those events are short periods of time that they happen, so you may not no longer need those lists, which means less work for you to bring them over to EOP. So take the time to go through and trim out those lists. There's some spam filtering examples, for example. Also, it gives you an opportunity to review your corporate policies and see if there's anything that's changed throughout the years. Maybe you had something in 5 years ago that's really the business has changed and it's not needed anymore. So again, it's an opportunity for some house cleaning. It's important to educate your users about spam and how to combat and protect themselves from it. Avoid using links in emails. Don't respond to those requests for sensitive information. Apparently, my bank this morning told me that my security settings needed to be updated. Not quite sure I believe that, so I need to look into that myself. Also need to take a look and review what they've actually signed up for. Go ahead and unsubscribe to those bulk lists, those known retailers that they shop at, or they don't shop at, but they thought they did, and get rid of those. Again, as Wendy talked about, we've mentioned it a couple of times, the junk mail reporting tool, excellent tool to let us know if there's something that we're not categorizing correctly. Couple of resources here, the Krabby Office Lady and the Outlook phishing detection articles are helpful in helping to educate your users on that as well. It's also helpful to publish an SPF record. This will help protect you as well so that spammers don't spoof your information. And I know I'm moving really, really fast. We did talk a little bit about bulk mail earlier. Also try and make sure that if you are scoping your allow messages through or your allow rules through, try and do it by IP address wherever possible. Domains are very easy to spoof, but IP addresses are a little trickier to spoof from, so it makes those rules a little bit more comprehensive. And we also recommend avoiding to safe list your own domain. Again, for the same reason, it's easy to spoof your domain. If you've got SPF checks in place, you're actually kind of negating that work if you add your own domains for whitelisting or safe listing. There is some direction in here on how to prevent the spam notifications going over to your distribution lists. Just a quick show of hands, anybody want me to go through this? Are you guys okay with this?
It's in the slides.
It is
get
in the
deck,
slides, so
the PowerShell's there.
Just quickly talking about some known issues and limitations, we've talked a little bit about the end user spam quarantine spam quarantine access coming in. Right now it is administrator only. The viewer has the ability to only see 500 messages, but it can be viewed with more in PowerShell. And there is also the information about releasing in bulk, which was a question that we had.
Those are hyperlinks. They'll take you to the article that tells you exactly how to do it.
Exactly. There's some message limits. Again, we still have the same message size limit of 150 megabytes. And with Office 365, the mailbox sizes, or the message sizes, is 35 megabytes. The other thing that's important to know is we have a maximum of 100 transport rules capabilities. So keep in mind that if you are using DLP, those are considered as part of the 100 transport rules.
And the transport rules are much more robust and flexible than the rules were in FOPI. So although 100 sounds like it's very few, it actually, they're so flexible.
They allow you to do more.
They allow you to do a lot more with one rule. So we talked a little bit about the MX for the on-premises send connector. If you want to use the different weighting, then use the host name instead of the round robin that we give, and this is just information on that.
And this one is a couple of things that are coming out soon, so keep your eyes open for it. We are being able to do match of subdomains. We're going to be supporting DKIM for inbound mail, and we are also moving forward with supporting IPv6 in the coming months. Last thing that I want to let you guys know about is the implementation project managers. They are a select group of folks that can be engaged for 1 to 5 days across a 90-day period. They'll provide you with personalized training. They'll go through your business needs with you. They'll go through the best practices specific for your organization to help you tweak what you need to do. It is eligible for customers that are over 1,000 seats that have EOP standalone, Office 365 dedicated, and there is an exception basis for Office 365 if you're setting up a hybrid environment. If you want an implementation project manager, you do have to have a Premier contract, so go ahead and talk to your town about how you get one involved.
Good.
There are other related sessions, and don't forget to fill out your surveys. Thank you so much.
Thank
you. If you have any other questions, please come up and see us.
Appreciate it.